time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
In smart beta, Vanguard and iShares still dominate. Single factor ETFs have been successful. If they really get strong track records, I think you might get people motivated to actually sit down and figure out what goes into these funds.
Cynthia, so great having you back on the podcast. I think it's been over a year, which is way too long.
Yeah, it's a long time. Thanks for having me.
No, pleasure having you back. So let's start with this story on ETF labeling, and then we can get into the piece you wrote last week on how top-heavy the ETF industry is and how smaller issuers can compete. I think that ties in perfectly with the controversy surrounding this labeling proposal. So look, there's a coalition of six ETF issuers. That includes the big three, right? iShares, Vanguard, State Street, and then also Schwab, Invesco, and Fidelity. And the long and short of it is they're proposing new ETF classifications, which, by the way, I don't take victory laps very often, but I did tweet out back in April that maybe this labeling should be reconsidered after the USO situation. I have to throw that out there. But I guess you first just want to explain the basics in terms of this proposal, and then we can get into the controversy surrounding this.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the most important thing here is to know that this is, like you said, not a new effort. And BlackRock really isn't the only one to push for this. I think it was 2 years ago, Morningstar was pushing for this. Ben Johnson wrote papers about it. I think Debbie Fuhrer has created her own classification suggestion. I think even Kathleen Moriarty at some point, the well-known attorney in the space, has done it. I think exchanges have tried. And at the end of the day, it's an effort that the SEC has not pushed forward because there has never been consensus in the industry. No one can get everyone on the same page to agree to the same nomenclature. And the truth is, Nate, this is, what, 27 years after SPY launched? So now we're going to start renaming products. So just to run over here briefly on what the categories that BlackRock and the consortium, as they call it, is proposing, would be exchange-traded funds, which applies to basically almost, 75% of all the products out there today anyway. Exchange-traded notes, again, a name we've been using for a long time for the debt obligations. The new categories would be exchange-traded commodities, which would put things like GLD, physical gold, would put USO, futures-based oil, all these commodity products, no longer would be called ETFs, they'd be called ETCs. And then I think the stickiest of the points here is the exchange-traded instruments, ETIs, which is the catch-all for everything else, including leverage and inverse products and defined outcome ETFs. I think a lot of the distaste, if you will, for this current proposal is this ETI category. I mean, first of all, what is an instrument? Everything out there is an instrument. So if the purpose of the new naming convention would be to clarify, I don't see how an ETI clarifies anything. Second of all, to put in a category, leverage and inverse funds, which are your riskier fare out there and some of the most misunderstood products out there in terms of implementation, with defined outcome ETFs, which are designed specifically to minimize risk exposure, the opposite of going all in on risk. And you're going to group those two things together? I think that's really confusing. So I think the debate going on is, one, can we even get new names to stick at this point, almost 30 years after the launch of the first one? Two is, do they actually really clarify anything or just add more confusion to an industry that's already full of acronyms, full of names? I mean, we all know, we talk about this all the time, how we love to make financial markets sound complicated, and I'm just not sure that this really helps make it simpler or just complicate things.
Okay, so I am reading between the lines that you're not necessarily the most supportive of this proposal. And by the way, I think we should also mention that effectively the exchanges, so Cboe, NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange, they would be tasked with enforcing this naming convention. You mentioned how the SEC did not include this, or, you know, it's been in front of them before, specifically as part of the ETF rule. But it wouldn't be the SEC enforcing, it would be the exchanges. But I guess let me ask you this, Cynthia. You know, I hear you with all the different, you have ETP, ETN, ETC, ETI. I do think the goal here is to try and help minimize investor confusion. And I think one of the other motivators here, too, is I think these issuers, they want to avoid a black eye for the industry. So if an investor has a bad experience with, let's say, a USO, or I think back to the XIV, the volatility product back in 2018, I think the thought is maybe investors might avoid all ETFs, right? And we know for a fact the financial media, they love to go wild on these stories. So I do think the larger issuers are worried that maybe a few bad apples can give the entire industry, maybe not a bad name, but certainly cause some people to pause before buying ETFs. So I do think that's a factor. But I guess going back to minimizing investor confusion, these products do have substantial differences. If you're looking at a plain vanilla ETF tracking, whatever, the S&P 500, and then you look at a leverage product, or you look at a product owning futures, don't you think there are some substantial differences there, that if there's a way we can flag those for the end investors, even if it's very basic, that might offer some benefit?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that, you know, risk profiles and the structure of these funds is very different. And I think as the industry matures, actually the complexity of the funds is getting more and more. I mean, your plain vanilla equity space is saturated. So we're seeing innovation in the form of, I don't know, portfolios with covered calls and underlying all sorts of stuff, that it gets more complex and more complex. So for the investor, it really is a big barrier to entry if you think in terms of education. Now, ETFs are also one of the five key attributes of ETFs is transparency. So if you really want, you work really hard for your money, are you not going to go check the website for a product or read something about this product before you buy? Are you going to buy USO without knowing that it owns front futures, oil futures, and then you get creamed and it's the ETF's fault? I just think I'm not sure that regulation is the way to protect you from yourself, basically, because the information in the ETF industry is out there, is fully available. White papers are fully available. It's an industry where it's really actually difficult to protect any sorts of intellectual property. And so we need to put new names to protect you, because you may not do your due diligence before you buy a product. I'm just not convinced that that's where a regulator really needs to step in. I think the conversation about, you know, the coverage about, you know, ETFs cause all the crashes, ETFs exacerbate liquidity problems, all the bad press ETFs get, every time something like a USO catches on fire, it's like a really kind of, it's stale. It's an old, tired narrative. I totally wish it would go away. Unfortunately, it sells because bad headlines sell. So I understand the motivation to avoid, as you put, the black eye that this industry gets all the time for the riskier players. I just don't know that it really levels the playing field by putting these things in different categories. Because, I mean, are market data desks now going to have to rebrand these things? Would maybe model portfolios just put screens where just, you know, exclude all ETIs? We're not going to touch that. Let's just stick with the ETFs because that keeps it simpler. I think you are in the end, you're by categorizing them, you might actually hurt the ability of these issuers to sell these products out there. And, I mean, we say it all the time, ETFs aren't bought, they're sold. And if we're making it more difficult for them to sell, I think that's anti-competitive. It's not necessarily, you know, leveling, making it fairer. It's making it more difficult to compete. It limits access. So I think it could be a downside to it.
My only pushback to that in terms of you know, hurting their ability to sell would be, I actually think that's part of the rationale with this proposal, in the sense that we know these products can be riskier for investors, and so maybe they shouldn't be available everywhere. And I always come back to the example, think about an investor opening up a direct futures account, or a margin account at a broker, they have to go through a process to do that, right? Brokerages don't just let any investor come and trade futures contracts or trade on margin. And so, you know, why should it be any different with leveraged ETFs or futures-based ETFs? Maybe there should be a more substantial hurdle there. And, you know, going back to one of your earlier points, I completely agree. I think ultimately it is the responsibility of the investor to know what they own. There's no question about that. I'm a huge, I always trumpet that fact. On the other hand, we know that there are inexperienced investors using products like USO. You can look at, you know, all, I hate pointing to Robinhood data, but it's an easy one to look at. I mean, you can see the spike in usage at places like Robinhood or SoFi. And I've seen, I know even talking to Laura Krieger there at ETF.com, she talked about how her email inbox was flooded with people asking, you know, what's going on with these products. And so I just come back to, I don't think this is a perfect proposal, but if there's small things that can help maybe raise a flag before somebody invests in these products, that could be beneficial. One thing I did want to ask you about, Cynthia, you know, I think a lot of the pushback on this proposal also, to your point, was a thought that it was anti-competitive and that it was somehow a nefarious scheme by larger issuers to keep a stranglehold on the industry. The issue I have with that is, I mean, think about how ruthless those larger providers are with each other, right? Just in chopping fees and launching competing products. And so, you know, all of a sudden, they're going to come together with a proposal to try to keep the little guys down and be anti-competitive. I just have a hard time believing that.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point, Nate. I also think, though, first, from what I've heard, I've talked to some people in this industry this week. I've talked to some of the exchanges for their perspective on this. And, you know, they banded together, but this is a BlackRock proposal. In fact, I was told by somebody that BlackRock said, these are the names, they're not open for negotiation. So join the bandwagon or not. And so it really isn't, I think, a industry push as much as it is the biggest player that owns, you know, 30%, 40% of this market saying, this is how this is going to go. They have a lot of muscle. The other thing is that, I mean, at the end of the day, this is really a marketing push because none of these five issuers in this consortium have any of the ETFs that would fall into these other categories like ETIs. So their naming convention basically puts all of their products in the ETF category, which is the acronym investors are comfortable with. So the issuers now have to go, you know, do the legwork of getting investor comfortable with what the heck is an ETI. It's not going to be them. Their products are totally covered in the ETF brand naming. So that's where I think this conversation comes about what's the real motivation here. Is it really fair? Is it not? Is it really about education or is it just a marketing opportunity? Is it, you know, like you said, to protect from this collective black eye when it's always, you know, a volatility product that burns people? So I think it's a discussion that in the end, if the SEC has been faced with this before, never moved forward because it couldn't get a consensus, I'm really curious to see if this time will be different. Is that all it took, you know, negative oil and people losing millions for in oil markets for this to really catch? So I'm really curious to see what happens next.
No, I am too. And, I went back and forth on this in terms of where I landed in supporting it. And I honestly see all sides. I can see all points. I do come back with smaller issuers. You know, look, they have a stake in the industry as well in terms of the reputation. And whether it's a product from a larger issuer or a smaller issuer, if something blows up and the financial media runs with it, that going back to the black eye, that can impact smaller issuers just as much as larger issuers. But look, I'll come back again and say I do believe the onus is ultimately on investors to make sure they know what they own. I do think that the ETF industry can do a better job. And I think I do view this as a positive step. I completely agree. Again, there are some shortcomings with the current proposal. I do think it should reside with the SEC. I agree you can make the case that leverage and inverse products should be a separate category. Maybe options-based ETFs and strategies like that, they have their own category, but we'll see what happens here. Cynthia, only a few minutes left. I do want to talk about this piece you wrote last week because I think it ties into the labeling controversy. Mm-hmm. And the piece was titled Smaller ETF Issuers Unlock Diversification. This is posted at ETF.com. Everyone should check this out. Let me read a portion of what you wrote. You said, quote, if the ETF industry itself were a single ETF holding 2,302 securities in a portfolio weighted by assets, it would be a very top-heavy strategy where five names represent 20% of the entire pie, which that's just remarkable. And you went on to explain how concentrated the ETF industry is, not just dominated by a handful of ETFs, but also a handful of issuers. And I do think that plays a role in the labeling proposal, to your point, just sort of this anti-competitive feeling from smaller issuers. However, in your piece, you did explain how smaller issuers can still find some success. So I guess, do you want to touch on both of these, just the concentration in the ETF space, but also the opportunity for smaller issuers?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's no surprise that we have the top three issuers have been at the top of this game for a very long time, from the beginning, really. So BlackRock, iShares, Vanguard, and State Street Global Advisors. And they tend to dominate market share, but they also tend to really not be the place where a lot of the innovation is anymore. So they benefit from, you know, scale, distribution, brand recognition, which goes a really long way in this business. But there really is, I think, a really cool and exciting place for innovation that tends to come a lot from the smaller players. Now, what surprised me when I was writing that article is I went back, you know, several years to see how much that concentration has changed over the years. And back to the 2010s, the three top issuers had controlled between 81 and 83% market share. Today, they have 83% market share. Every other year, with the exception of last year when it went above 90, they've been in that 81 to 83% range. So I thought that was fascinating, that as concentrated as it is and as dominated as it is by these three players, smaller issuers have actually been battling it out in that bottom 20% for at least 10 years. And I think that's really cool to see, actually. So are we ever going to dethrone a BlackRock, a Vanguard, or State Street? Chances are we are not. But there is plenty of room out there to innovate, especially as ETFs continue to grow and reach new investors and, you know, reach down to, you know, more and more retail crowd. And so I think there's some exciting opportunity here.
I completely agree. I think the innovation absolutely occurs among the smaller issuers in the ETF space. I know you specifically mentioned ARK Invest, Innovator ETFs, Defiance ETFs. I'm just curious, do you see any commonality here in terms of their recipe for success?
You know, I think there's a few things that have helped them. I think one of the most important ones has been a really strong DNA. So it's to get your brand, when you're going to go market an ETF, you've got to go through, you know, your classic marketing funnel, right? Awareness, consideration, purchase, loyalty. A lot of these ETF issuers, if they come out with a Me Too product and you're not quite sure what it does and it doesn't have a really strong characteristic, you never really get past that awareness with investors. So to really get trickled down to consideration and hit the point where investors will buy your product, I think having a really clear DNA works. For example, ARK Invest. When you hear the word ARK, you immediately think of Cathie Wood and the amazing active management research that they do and their, you know, disruptive tech focus, and that becomes their calling card in a way. Defiance, the same thing. You know, it's that next generation type of thematic investing, very focused. Innovator, I mean, that's all we talk about is buffer ETFs. It became the name of the segment, buffer ETFs, and that was all driven by Innovator. So I think you're having a very clear, defined, I think the era, the space for a broadly diversified lineup of ETFs, there is a bunch of Me Too funds, is over. I don't think you can really carve a niche that way anymore. I think you have to have a very strong DNA. I think you have to, you know, hopefully be lucky enough to come up with a first-to-market type of strategy. We saw that type of success happen, for example, when HACT came to market, the cybersecurity ETF, it was first, and it became synonym with investing in cybersecurity. First Trust, you know, a year later or something, launched a competing fund, Cyber, which is very successful too, but when you talk cybersecurity, HACT is the ticker that comes to mind. Same thing with Amplify iBuy, the online retail ETF. Now, there are others in the market from like ProShares and, you know, competitors in the space, but you think of iBuy when you think of online retail. So I think being first to market is super helpful if you're trying to break a new segment, but most important of all is, like, if they say ETFs aren't bought, they're sold. If that's the case, you have to have good sales and distribution. If you're not getting your ETF out there in front of people, and whether that means going door to door, whether that means strong marketing campaigns, social media presence, all that stuff, I think, you know, you have to be out there selling them. Otherwise, even the best ideas just die.
Cynthia, just a minute left, sort of tying this all together back with the ETF labeling proposal. You mentioned intellectual property earlier. You talked about anti-competitive. Do you think the bigger issue here is that larger providers can simply cherry pick the best ideas from smaller providers? You know, it feels like the smaller issuers can almost be a farm system for the larger providers. And I just wonder if that feeds into some of the animosity when a proposal like the ETF labeling one comes up. Do you agree that's a bigger issue?
Yeah, there's no question that there's really no way to protect your IP in this business.
I agree.
I mean, this is the business of transparency. So all your research, all you do, all your portfolios are out there. Maybe in active management, a little bit better. But I think, again, it comes down to that strong DNA. If you think of Defiance, their 5G ETF, which is a global telecom fund on connectivity, it's $265 million now after a year launch. It competes with an iShares fund that has been in the market for 19 years, and the Defiance ETF is bigger already in 1 year. So I think there's an element of some great ideas can get lost in the shuffle of these bigger players because they have so much out there. So I think it's really the opportunity here is make your name, your brand, become that segment in a way, you know. And so that, you know, are you going to go look for a next generation connectivity ETF in the iShares lineup? No, you're probably going to go to this Defiance one because that's all they do. So I think you have to really play that card hard, but you have to be really good at it too because there's a lot of spaghetti at the wall that doesn't stick. So this industry discards the dead weight very quickly. So you've got to be good at what you do.
No, I completely agree. I mean, you mentioned being first to market. I think that's important. Certainly showing the commitment that it's in your DNA, that you know, you have a value proposition. All of those are highly important. Cynthia, great having you back on. Really enjoyed the conversation this week. We'll have to do this sooner, not wait a year next time. But thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That was ETF.com, Cynthia Murphy.